Yeah, man. You count with this, man. Whatever it is, it ain't enough. Cause I need some more.
Money, trying to keep it in something ugly, can't be front and bumming. Dead presidents run the country, debit or credit. Paper or plastic, whatever suits you. I'm used to never having enough to put it.
Hello and welcome to another edition of Money and Values, a show about the economy, about the changing value of money, but more importantly about the changing nature of money. Everyone knows that the value of money changes over time. What you can buy today is different than what you could buy with the same amount of money 20 years ago. Less familiar is the fact that the nature of money, what money is and how it functions, changes as well, and those changes have far-reaching consequences. We're in a period where the nature of money is about to change dramatically again, and that's something we'd like to talk about on today's issue of Money and Values. My name's Dave Adelson, and I'm speaking to Max Fraud Wolf. Max is a trained economist working out of New York. Max, how you doing this morning?
I'm fine. It's nice to be here and nice to have the listeners. Thank you for tuning in.
Thank you very much. Today is Saturday, November 22nd, 2008. And we wanted to start off talking a little bit about some of the people who are going to be driving changes in our financial architecture, and then talk about financial architectures past, present, and future a little more extensively. And we've just had news yesterday a couple of big announcements about people and key posts in the Obama administration. Max, do you want to talk about that a little?
Okay, well, we're still at an unconfirmed status here, but it looks like Timothy Geithner, who has, since for the last several years, since I think 2003, so about 5 years now, has been the New York Fed Board governor, so the 12 regional banks of the Federal Reserve, the sort of most important, the first among equals, tends to be New York because it tends to do more of the international monetary interactions and more of the market interventions by the Fed, because the markets and the international markets are kind of run through and around and in New York. And so he's going to leave the New York Federal Reserve governor position, and he'll become the Treasury Secretary that replaces Hank or Henry Paulson when he leaves with the Bush administration at the end of January 2009.
And there was also an announcement about a leaked rumor that Larry Summers, who had been another candidate for that position, who was formerly Treasury Secretary in the Clinton years, late of Harvard University, was potentially going to be selected to replace Bernanke as Fed Chair.
Some folks have said that. I think the sort of most widely held belief at this point is that Lawrence Summers will actually become the head economic advisor to the White House.
And before we go on to talk about one other person who is not named yet but very prominent in all of this, namely Robert Rubin, I want to confirm with you a perception I have that the major financial regulatory institutions, their purpose is to control changes in the value of money, and one of the things that characterizes the period we're in is that the horse has left the barn, and they basically are not able to control or manage the pace and nature of changes in the functioning of money and the value of money, and that the calls that are coming now for a new financial architecture, a somewhat more global regulatory framework, are attempts for governments and central banks to gain control again of money and the functioning of money when they've lost control of it. Would you say that's a reasonable formulation of what's going on right now?
Yeah, I wouldn't dispute any portion of that. What we actually have in the U.S. is a rat's nest of overlapping different regulatory agencies, more than a dozen, which also have bald spots. So they overlap one another in ways that are, shall we say, less than efficient, and that's a pretty diplomatic choice of phrase on my part. And also, we have other large areas of financial economy where there is, in fact, no functioning regulatory authority. Of the various regulatory authorities we have, Treasury has a sort of open, overarching, open-ended role, and, of course, is the official writer of checks on behalf of the U.S. government and collector of taxes, fees, and revenues on behalf of the U.S. government. And we've seen in the present crisis and under the leadership of Secretary Paulson a huge new assertion of Treasury power in sort of areas and to a degree that we haven't really seen in quite a long time. And I assume that people expect that to continue as Paulson resigns or leaves office with the Bush administration and Geithner replaces him. In the sort of most direct way, what various government regulatory agencies do is oversee their type of institution or type of activity, and they try to kind of target some combination of smooth functioning of various institutions, the quantity of money in circulation, which of course affects its value, and the interest rate or the price of borrowing money, which of course also affects the value of money.
And one of the key changes in the regulatory framework that people have talked about recently a great deal was the elimination of the Glass-Steagall Act. What was it, 10 years ago now?
Just about exactly 10 years ago.
And can you remind listeners who aren't familiar with it what the Glass-Steagall Act was?
Okay, there are really two acts. One is the Glass-Steagall Act, named for one member of the U.S. House and one member of the U.S. Senate. A lot of what people traditionally mean when they talk about Glass-Steagall is actually covered by the Banking Act of 1934. So if we put the two of them together, they were responses to the Great Depression and the massive failure. I mean, over 5,000 banks went under in the United States between 1929 and 1933. So they were really a response to the massive destruction in the financial sector in the United States in the Great Depression, or the early years of the Great Depression. And the idea was that we needed to have a much more regulated and overseen financial system, and we needed to chop it up or firewall the various portions of it, commercial banks, from investment banks, from insurance companies particularly, the idea being that the banks that loan to businesses should be separate from the banks that help businesses raise money by selling stocks or partial ownership in themselves, or bonds, pledges of future repayment, that should be walled off. And insurers should be walled off from both commercial and investment banks, so that if we had a problem, like a firewall, these regulatory separations would prevent the fire from literally spreading institution to institution and doing damage like a fire can to the guts of all different segments of the U.S. financial economy, which had been the experience in the period of the 1929, really through 1937.
And so can you talk a little bit about the timing, mechanism, and rationale by which Glass-Steagall was reversed or overturned or eliminated?
Okay, well, probably a central figure in the reverse or elimination of Glass-Steagall Banking Act of 1934 was Robert Rubin, who is considered to have been the mentor to Larry Summers and possibly also Tim Geithner, the new Treasury Secretary, although it's some say that it's actually Rubin who sort of cultivated Summers, and then Summers in return cultivated Geithner. Either way, all very much connected. So Mr. Rubin was sort of the central figure. He had been at the Treasury. His hand-picked successor and previously his under-Treasury Secretary, Larry Summers, took over when he left. He left having just allowed a merger of Travelers Insurance and Citigroup. And this merger violated the separation between insurance companies, investment banks, and commercial banks, because the new Citigroup, Citibank and Travelers, had within it insurance companies under the Travelers rubric, Salomon Smith Barney, an investment bank, and Citigroup, a commercial and retail bank. And so the joining of them implicitly violated the provisions of the 1934 Bank Act and Glass-Steagall, and under Treasury Secretary Rubin and under Treasury Secretary Larry Summers, the deal was allowed with a 5-year provision that the firm would have to break itself back up if these regulations weren't abolished within 5 years, although quickly thereafter, within about 6 months, the regulations were abolished and Citigroup was allowed to exist because those laws were no longer in effect.
Who abolished those laws?
The Congress, although it was drafted with advice from then-Treasury Secretary Rubin and Under-Secretary Summers and approved by then-Fed Reserve Governor Greenspan.
So Mr. Rubin was a key figure in that. Presumably he did it for a reason. What was the rationale at the time for taking down the firewalls?
the rationale at the time, which I think Mr. Rubin would have been very much in agreement with, the leading lights in the House, the Senate, the various regulatory agencies, and the leading economics departments. I mean, of course, there are always critics, but that was the sort of leading wisdom of the day, was more or less that free and unrestrained markets are the shortest, fastest, surest way to prosperity, and government regulations, particularly those left over from the Great Depression, were outdated, ineffectual, and basically likely to be retardants to progress and wealth, that the championship emerging industries in the United States were largely financial services and high tech, and that continuing to inhibit them was basically inhibiting the United States in terms of its prosperity, its global competitiveness, and its growth.
But how did that separation inhibit the funding of the business operations of those sectors?
The argument is that just as we allow conglomerization in other businesses.
Is that a word?
Conglomerization?
Yeah.
Sure, turning into conglomerates. The sort of iconic American conglomerate being General Electric, which
right.
really does everything from financial services to light bulbs to nuclear bombs and more or less anything in between. So sort of a huge conglomerate operating over multiple business lines. The vision for Citigroup under then CEO Sandy Weill and very shortly thereafter co-CEO and board member Robert Rubin was to produce a financial supermarket which, like many other kinds of businesses that had conglomerized or turned into conglomerates, would be literally a full-service financial supermarket doing everything from individual credit cards, in which Citibank was always a huge player and still is, to auto loans and home mortgages and investment banking and insurance products, and that they could pool all these various activities, achieve economies of scale, and be better servicers to their clients because they could literally take care of all the financial needs of their clients with economies of scale, cost-saving efficiencies, and much the way a supermarket had evolved as a more efficient solution in many people's minds to 25 little independent stores, you know, so where one can go to the Safeway or to the Albertsons, or these days a Walmart, and buy literally anything. The idea was the same could be offered in financial services if only we could get rid of regulations made in the sort of anti-market regulatory zeal of the Great Depression.
And so this act was overturned, and then Citigroup was allowed to...
It was de facto overturned by the creation of Citigroup from Citibank and Travelers, and then de jure, or in the law, overturned by an act of Congress within about 6 months.
And so once that happened, I understand that Rubin, when he left the Treasury, actually went to work for the newly formed conglomerate Citigroup.
He did, and his undersecretary who assisted in all this, Larry Summers, also who had as his employee Tim Geithner, stayed at the Treasury and helped to sort of, let's say, shepherd the passage of those repeals, and very much were in the same ideological vein as their former mentor and boss, Rubin, who ended up over at Citibank, Citigroup.
And now Rubin's been at Citigroup ever since. In what capacity?
He has a somewhat hard-to-pin-down capacity. He's co-chairman of the board of directors of the Citigroup Corporation.
And is it known, I mean, that's a title, but is it known what he does in that capacity?
He's basically a very senior strategy advisor who then takes on specific projects that he and the board deem particularly vital or particularly well-aligned to his set of skills and connections.
And so, in a sense, he's going to be playing a similar kind of role with respect to the entire financial system now, given that his protégés are going to be in key positions within the administration. Would you say that's a fair statement?
Well, we'd have to conjecture about how much influence and discussion he has with Summers and Geithner. It's not clear. Certainly, probably much more importantly than the presence or absence of individual responsibility or control is that Rubin represents, you know, in many ways the best and the brightest of a certain philosophy. And that philosophy, or at least students and believers in that philosophy, remain... And to all appearances at this point, remain just as firmly in control of the Obama White House as they were of the Clinton White House, and to some extent of the Bush 1 and Bush 2 White Houses.
Well, you've made the point in previous shows that it's the time, not time's not the man that really determine, not the person,
right.
Let's say, that determines the decisions that get made. And I'm curious, the times have obviously changed. Is there any way of reading the tea leaves and getting a sense of what the philosophy that these people shared and acted on in the prior period might lead them to do in this period?
Sure. I mean, the age makes the decision, not the people, I think would be the more eloquent way than I had said it before. However, the educational background, the membership in various clubs and organizations, and the milieu in which Summers and Paulson and Rubin and Geithner et al. Functioned will limit, in all extent, how far they want to go in regulation and interference in the markets, and does belie a certain faith in financial markets, at least when they are functioning. And I think people kind of understand that right now the financial markets are kind of oscillating between really inadequate levels of function and total seize-up dysfunction and stoppage. So clearly we need to change the rules a bit and make some substantive interventions just to sort of restart the engine here. But these types of folks are going to be likely to advocate the sort of least intervention that will possibly work and will probably be maximally interested in removing or watering down some of the regulation and intervention as soon as there's some kind of consensus that things are returning to quote-unquote normal or better function in the financial markets. And they're likely, therefore, to be shocked if that doesn't happen or if it takes a long time. And we've seen that in this sort of patchwork, catch-as-catch-can, responsive and not proactive series of reactions that have come out of the New York Fed, the other regional Feds, the chairmanship of the Fed with Bernanke, the Treasury with Paulson, and the other regulatory agencies, with the possible exception of another rising star, Sheila Bair, over at the FDIC, or Federal Deposit Insurance Corporation.
So if the Rubin, Summers, Geithner group represent one philosophy, what would be the term that summarizes that philosophy? And how could you distinguish its key difference from the philosophy of somebody like a Milton Friedman and the group of people who adhere to his philosophy? What are those two worldviews, and what's the term that summarizes them and identifies them? I think of neoliberal and neoconservative, but that's not a direct graft, is it?
Neoliberal is often a term that's used by people who are not particularly fans of that Washington consensus, sometimes called the Treasury complex or the Anglo-American complex. That refers largely to the advice given by American financial regulators led by the U.S. Treasury, and that's been true over the last 20 years or so, that robust deregulated financial markets are an essential ingredient to global growth, and that everyone should sort of model their financial markets along the least regulated is best regulated model coming out of the United States and the U.K., and open them up to global competition. So that's sort of often the Washington consensus view. That's a small piece of it, but it's a sort of view from 10,000 feet on the financial regulatory suggestions of the Washington consensus or the neoliberal view. The people associated with Milton Friedman are often referred to as monetarists, and the idea there being they see the role of the money supply as particularly of ultimate importance in the economy. They tend to want to not target interest rates, but target the quantity of money. And they have been sort of on the outs for direct policy control since the end of Reagan and the beginning of Bush 1, because various experiments with monetarist policy, targeting the quantity of money more than the interest rate, were not seen as particularly successful by the field in economics and led to some sort of significant policy misadventures.
But so I understood that people who were adherents of Milton Friedman and his ideas about markets were very much in control in recent period, and that there's not too much difference from the sort of neoliberal open market view. But one of the things that I don't understand also is I understood that changes by the Federal Reserve in the interest rate were basically equivalent to changes in the money supply. So
money supplies and interest rates affect each other very much, but a sort of very orthodox, doctrinaire, Friedmanite, monetarist position is not shared by folks like Rubin, Summers, Geithner et al. It's a different view. They do share a commitment to the notion of free market efficiency being much better than government regulation, and they do share political commitments to deregulation, to free trade, and to pressure being placed on various governments, particularly when they need loans from the IMF or the U.S. government or the international community. They do share a commitment to putting enormous pressure on these folks to deregulate their financial sectors, to allow in global banks and free flow of money, to remove things like capital controls, which restrict and tax how much money can be moved in and out of a country, what are sometimes called Tobin taxes, which put additional taxes on speculation in an effort to raise money and dissuade folks from speculating, and you know, a whole host of restrictions and regulations. The neoliberal and monetarist communities were very much working together to remove these restrictions, which they shared a belief were reducing the prosperity, speed, and success, both of the U.S. and the global economy, although there are differences in exactly what kind of monetary policy the two different groups advocate. But politically, they were able to work together quite a bit, particularly when they found themselves facing off against various governments or economists that believed in a much more conscribed and regulated place for finance in an economy.
When you talk about some of these policies, I can't help but think that what they're saying is, hey, we want the Treasury departments to have all the regulatory control and nobody else. We don't want any incursion in the power of, not just the power of money, but the power of the money regulatory institutions. It feels like a tug of war, because some of those other, quote, protectionist taxes or things of that sort, you know, are efforts by governments to make decisions about how money will flow and what industries or economic activities will be favored versus disfavored. And to say that, well, we want it to be free, it seems to me a bit of a euphemism or a shell game, because in reality, you still have regulatory institutions who are controlling the way money's flowing through changes in things like central bank interest rates. It's just not done directly. It basically says money gets to do whatever it wants to do, and we can change the value of money. Political, social considerations can't enter in.
Sure. Well, money has no independent will, right? Money is a thing or a process. So people and institutions have wills or interests or agendas. And you're definitely correct in the following. All regulatory bodies have a tendency to push to defend their turf and to limit the authority and scope of competitors. And I don't think the Treasury is immune from having ever done that. I don't think it's unique in having done that. But that is correct. There's always some regulatory battle there. But partly what these folks were kind of famous for, and remain somewhat famous for, although a bit less, were things like really, really working hard against allowing the Federal Trade or the Futures and Commodities Commission to come in and regulate derivatives. They really did largely believe that the large financial institutions that were in part created by many mergers and deregulations would be best at self-regulating and that having various government agencies would be expensive and likely would be money that was used to basically inefficiently restrict private enterprise.
Could you describe derivatives a little bit for people who aren't too familiar with it? The term refers to many different classes of securities and financial instruments. So what exactly is a derivative?
Sure. The derivatives, again, as you sort of wisely pointed out, is a huge, broad group. It's a little bit catch-all, so it's not that important without starting to put adjectives and descriptors. But the term comes from calculus, the basic idea. And in calculus, you know, mathematics, a derivative is something which takes its value from something else, right? Its value is derivative of the movement of something else.
Well, technically a derivative is the slope of a curve.
Yeah, so it would be change, right?
Right.
But the value of the value of a derivative is actually the measurement of change in something else. In financial markets, you can make contracts, so long as it's legal, you can make a contract where the value of that contract, which you can then buy and sell, is based on the value of something else. About 90% of the outstanding derivatives are in fact contracts that have to do with interest rates or the various rate of foreign exchange between currencies, the price between currencies. And one way to think about derivatives are they were a whole new class of ballooning in its size, you know, going from a relatively small market 20 years ago to a market with a notional value north of $100 trillion by last year.
What's notional value mean?
Well, the contracts have face values,
okay.
Right? But many of these contracts cancel each other out and are event-specific, so that if you net them out because they overlap, or if you take account of the fact that there's a low probability of some of these events ever taking place, the actual value of outstanding contracts is not known, but is known to be much lower than the sum total of just adding up all the face values.
So basically, if I bought insurance on a security and then I turned around and sold insurance on that same security, the net amount of money that goes out of my hands is the difference between the values of the sale and the purchase. And when you talk about the actual value, what you're saying is the amount of money that would have to change hands if a triggering event occurred is substantially lower than the total face value of all contracts because there's canceling out.
Absolutely. So the gross value and the net value would be hugely divergent.
Mm-hmm.
You'd have a gross value that had, you know, double, triple, quintuple, whatever, counting, and then a net value would remove all that double, triple, nth counting effect and massively reduce the total value.
And so one of the problems we have now is even if you didn't have regulation, not only do you not have regulation, but you don't even have tracking. So an economist like yourself who spends time looking at such things can't even tell me what these numbers are, and the various regulatory agencies who are trying to figure out how in the world to respond to these meltdowns can't exactly know the effect of any of what they're doing because there's no central record of what is even there. So you can't even calculate the risks anymore. So is that correct?
Well, risks and counterparties are hard to calculate. That's definitely true.
What's a counterparty?
So you may have all kinds of people who, say, sold a contract. In other words, they may have sold a derivative-like contractual product, which says, okay, if Ford Motor Company goes bankrupt, we will pay you 28% of your losses on the bankruptcy of Ford Motor Company in this class of Ford-issued bonds. Now, the value of that insurance rises as people become more concerned that Ford may go bankrupt, right? But we don't know there's no central clearing facility. I mean, at this point, the Federal Reserve and the Chicago Board of Trade are looking at setting one up, but we don't know for sure how many people sold how much insurance, how solvent they are, and if they can in fact pay off.
So this argument that, well, free unrestricted market in these financial instruments, and when I hear derivatives, what I understand also is these are things that can be sort of created without end. In other words,
they're just contracts.
You have a
contract.
Right. You have a company. There's only the one company. You sell shares in the company, but you can sell contracts about that are bets basically on the value of those shares. You can create as many of those as you want. You can have an industry that creates those things over and over again. The argument that says,
what limits how many you can create is how much a market there is to buy them.
But you can at least conceivably create markets to trade paper, and in a world in which, you know, young people decide to go into finance because it's less demanding and it's more rewarding than other fields, you have lots and lots of people who are running around doing this stuff and trading it and all the rest of it. But
think about all these financial contracts,
right,
serve a few purposes, right? And in the standard evolution of a financial market, usually you get an innovative product which makes a lot of money for the firm and the individual sometimes who innovate it. mm-hmm. which is genuinely and generally designed to reduce risk. So in a world where everything is done with borrowed money and an awful lot of things are done across international boundaries, there's an enormous demand for products that would help reduce your risk from the interest rate changing or reduce your risk from currencies changing.
Right. But the argument is that the product reduces risk. But the reality was that there was no way to calculate what true risk was because none of these unregulated markets led to an accounting anywhere of what was going on. And so how do you calculate, how
sure.
do you make the argument that you can calculate risk in that environment?
Okay? That's the spin out of these markets. So the evolutionary process usually runs something like this. The presence of risk or the perception of risk, right, about future movements in interest rates or currencies creates a legitimate demand through real international trade and through financing things with debt for some way to lay off, what they call lay off or sell to someone else, some of the risk you're taking on interest rate movements or on currencies. Then a very legitimate and helpful market springs up in order to try to sell products to people involved in international borrowing and lending or trade to offset some of these risks. And that part is probably the healthy early stage with innovation. What has happened around the world lately, and particularly in the United States and in the financial markets, is every new product that is developed to try to reduce the risk in speculative markets quickly becomes its own giant unregulated speculative market where people stop buying and selling and producing derivatives just to be able to do real business with less risk, and it becomes a whole frenzied sort of wild market full of speculation where these products stop being produced in relation to trade and contracts to reduce risk or share risk, which might be a useful actual process, and become the object of wild speculation. And then they stop being insurance products that reduce the riskiness, and they themselves become so risky that instead of creating a way to share and reduce risk, when they become speculative markets full of frenzy and froth, they increase systemic risk instead of decreasing it as they were supposed to.
So pardon me for being a cynic, but it seems to me that these people who are, as you have said repeatedly, so intelligent, it seems to me that these people, well, let me frame it a different way. How could they not recognize that that's the obvious conclusion if they have any historical knowledge about how markets have functioned in the past or human nature or anything else? In other words, how do you just become blind to the reality that that is a very real risk with a historical precedent?
I think the easy answer is one word, and it's called faith. I mean, if you're operating from a position where you ultimately believe that the best way to go is to have faith in the market, then you assume in the long term, despite no doubt much short-term pain and wild oscillation, in the long term, relatively unfettered markets will, with whatever bumps in the road notwithstanding, work you toward the best final resting place. Then, despite the counterfactuals and the trouble, you would assume that left to their own devices, markets will bungle their way toward the place that we should best be, and various interactions and involvements in those markets are likely not to really help us get to the best place.
Well, there's the old Sinclair Lewis line about it being very hard to get a man to understand something his salary depends upon him not understanding. But we could argue that it's faith, or we could be somewhat more cynical and say they understood very well that there would be this kind of blow up, but what they thought was that they would be able to manage it, or the sectors that they favored, the economic sectors that they, or national sectors that they favored, would be able to weather it, and indeed that it would be to the advantage of those sectors and to the detriment of people who, or, you know, institutions or countries or what have you, that they really weren't worried about.
Yeah, I mean, the other way you could sort of see it, which would be kind of the way I see it, is I think they did realize there were real problems. And be careful here. There were lots of people, you know, the voices in the woods screaming that there was trouble for years. And, you know, not to toot my own horn, and I was certainly...
Go ahead, toot your horn.
I was certainly one of thousands of people who you could put on that list.
You were among the thousands of people who don't count when they say nobody saw this coming.
Right, but I was one of thousands of people who don't count, for sure, who saw this coming. Not exactly this. I mean, no one forecasts exactly what happens, but one of many people who were very concerned. And I think a lot of the regulators and a lot of the cheerleaders for this were concerned. But I think what happened is they had enough faith that they kind of pushed this, and there was enough benefit in this deregulated, new innovative financial markets. And we can discuss what I mean by benefit in a minute, but there was enough benefit that by the time people realized how kind of dangerous and out of control it was, the perception was it had gotten so big that trying to solve the problem would actually just create a huge disaster now. And people kind of hoped that we could grow and innovate our way out of it without having to have the financial reckoning day. And unfortunately, that led to a kind of conspiracy of silence and error, which ultimately made the financial reckoning day, or years, as unluck would have it, that we're in now, much worse. But I do think that by 2005, 2006, a lot of people knew there was real trouble coming. The problem was that they weren't sure what to substitute, because the economy really hasn't had strong, consistent, shared organic growth in the United States in a long time. So to some extent, a long-term, moribund economy was seen as less good than a series of bubbles. And as long as you could inflate the next bubble big enough, fast enough, you could get yourself into a situation where at least some of these folks would argue a series of larger and larger bubbles was our best option.
So I wanted to go back to what we talked about a little bit at the open, which is the changing nature of money and how it relates to financial architectures. And I tend to think that events like the creation of the central bank in the United States, the Federal Reserve System in 1913, the Bretton Woods agreements in the post-war period, changes in the currency peg in the 70s and coming off the gold standard, all those things change what money is because they change how it functions. Is that a reasonable way to think of it? And what happens when the nature of money changes, for example, when you change your currency peg? Could you take us through a couple of the major events in the financial architecture of the world and talk a little bit about that phenomenon?
Sure. A financial architecture, I mean, and there's much controversy on exactly how to define something like this. But financial architecture is really the system of institutions and regulations that oversee the production and valuation and cost of money. And when you have any kind of systemic or seismic shift or change in the value of money, it sends shockwaves through the economy and then to the society writ large, given the central role of money in markets, because we use money as a measure of value, as a store of value, and as a means of exchange. And so it has so many and such an important set of utilizations and purposes, and also money as an asset, that really you're affecting assets, you're affecting the measurement of things, you're affecting the store of value, and you're affecting the ability to exchange values. So anything that really reshapes the value or price of money or the quantity of money is going to have far-reaching and profound effects. The bigger the alteration you make in the social role of money or value of money, the bigger the systemic and social impacts.
So a change in the financial architecture changes who and how the value of money can be altered.
Sure. The first major sort of attempt to rein in the wild excesses of free market money was made in 1865, actually, at the end of the Civil War, when the government set up a special police agency that's tasked with overseeing the purity of our money supply, called the Secret Service. Their sort of historically important role was actually not guarding the president. That came later. But their actually historically important role, about for the first 90 years they existed, the Secret Service, was to safeguard the money, because we didn't used to have a central monetary authority. Banks actually printed their own money against whatever gold or precious assets they had in their vaults, and there wasn't a central government organization for doing that.
Don't you mean they wrote it against whatever gold they claimed they had in their vaults?
Right. Well, ideally, whatever they had in their vaults, and if they were unscrupulous, then yeah, whatever they sort of fantasized, hoped, or defrauded people into thinking they had.
Wait. I thought that we can trust free markets.
Well, there would be some who would argue that. In 1865, just in case you're sort of interested, the best estimates made by the government at the time about how much of the money was counterfeit, the best estimates they had, which was part of the reason they authorized the Secret Service, was a little bit north of 40% of all circulating U.S. currency was counterfeit. So you have a pretty serious problem there.
God.
If just under half of the money in circulation is fake.
So now we have the situation where there's much less of it that's fake, but it still can't be trusted.
We do have counterfeiting problems, by the way. Those are ongoing, and the Secret Service maintains, among many other law enforcement agencies around the world, maintains an attempt to make some sort of major inroads into reducing counterfeiting of money. It is still a problem. It is nowhere near a problem of the scope and scale that it was in the pre-regulatory days there, like in the 1860s, and actually up before 1913. If you look closely at any U.S. currency in your possession, you'll see that across the top of what we call cash or paper money, it actually says Federal Reserve Note, because part of what happened in 1913 was the Federal Reserve Act, which set up the Federal Reserve System and actually removed from private banks the right to print their own money. And it has been the case ever since 1913, and remains the case now, that only the Federal Reserve has the right to either create or destroy paper money. No one else is allowed to do that, and in fact, if they are caught doing those things, they spend a long time in federal prison.
So that change, when that happened, that was a really fundamental change in what money is.
It replaced all these private banks and private markets with, sort of ironically, if you're a big free market person, I guess, the most central iconic commodity or store of value in the free market economy, money, is completely a government operation.
And it's interesting because I've never heard anybody claiming to be a free marketeer to say there shouldn't be a Federal Reserve.
There is a group who do make that claim, by the way. And you may hear more from them of late, given the fact that the Federal Reserve, if its job is to prevent inflation, debasement of the currency, and monetary disturbance, could be seen not to have, say, performed beautifully over the last several years.
And
so you may hear more from them.
Is little libertarians?
Yes, this would be a subsection of the libertarian. In my opinion, the sort of smartest, most eloquent folks from this group, many of whom are good economists with many interesting insights, can be found at the von Mises Institute, the Daily Reckoning, and some of them, their work even appears at a place I've done a bunch of work, which is the Prudent Bear.
Well, a topic for another time may be the libertarian philosophy, but for the time being, I'd like to get back to the question of financial architecture. So you said the creation of the Secret Service to surveil the creation of money and counterfeiting was one key moment. The creation of the Federal Reserve was another. What was Bretton Woods? Because I hear a lot about Bretton Woods these days and the need for a new Bretton Woods.
Okay, well, Bretton Woods, it was actually the name of a country club in New Hampshire in which the soon-to-be formal victors in World War II met with a few principal ideas in mind. Representing England in this negotiation, the former superpower, financial superpower, which had fallen apart during World War I and World War II, and it was during the trouble for England between World War I and World War II that the dollar began the process of replacing the pound sterling, and that New York City began to steal away and usurp the position of global financial capital from London. So in this meeting in a place called the Bretton Woods Country Club in New Hampshire in the United States, Lord John Maynard Keynes, a famous inventor of Keynesian economics, representing the UK, and a gentleman named Harry Dexter White, who's not known to that many Americans, but should be, one of the most important, powerful shapers of the modern reality of the world, who's unfortunately not all that well known. Harry Dexter White represented the United States, and they had two goals, or the folks meeting there, along with the European representatives, and that was to remake a global economy which could have real trade and cooperation, but wouldn't have so much speculative financial activity that it destabilized the fledgling new international economy that people were trying to build. These meetings, of course, took place in the shadow of a Great Depression, where the prevailing wisdom, particularly from Keynes, was that it was the free choice of entrepreneurs, and particularly the role of speculative markets, in destabilizing the world economy that had produced the poverty of the 30s and the cataclysmic war of the first half of the 1940s. And so it was a meeting quite hostile to international financial markets and quite suspicious of banks, looking to curtail and limit their operation to those things that were needed for mass employment, mass growth of economies, and international trade. Particularly Keynes looks to limit, representing the United Kingdom, and particularly Harry Dexter White looks to solidify the United States as the central power and the central rule maker in the new world economy, at least of the non-communist or free world, as they called it then. And that was done building a global financial architecture around the U.S. dollar as the basically new pound sterling / gold of a global economic system with a limited role for banks and fixed currencies fixed to the new center of the global financial system, the U.S. dollar. And it's worthy of mention that in 1945, at the end of World War II, the rest of the world was so much more decimated than a newly invigorated United States was, that about 50% of world GDP, or market output, was being done inside the United States of America.
Wow, that's an incredible percentage.
20% now, so more than 2.5 times as much as now.
So how was that aim of controlling the speculative excess achieved mechanistically?
Actually, it was the beginning of a series of rules and regulations made by something called the IBRD, the International Bank for Reconstruction and Development, which you now know as the World Bank, the IMF, which was in its larval stage then, the UN, the U.S. Treasury, NATO, and their European Economic Community about 15 years later. Basically, the idea was that the United States would be the center of a rebuilding and then a global economy based on the dollar with fixed exchange rates to prevent speculation in various exchange rates and limited controlled banking systems, so that banks and speculation from banks and financial markets and investors couldn't destabilize the global economy, and very restricted banking practices in which movements of money for speculative purposes were basically either heavily taxed or illegal, in which countries were supposed to have more or less balanced trade with each other, and in which countries which had surpluses should try to A, lend some short-term money to countries with deficits, and try to look to balance. One of the series of major battles between the Americans and the British at that meeting was whether or not the countries that had deficits should be forced to change, or whether the countries that had surpluses should be forced to change. And the United States, the country with the biggest surpluses the world had ever seen, won that battle. And so even in Bretton Woods, you saw the beginning of it was the country in deficit, and therefore with the weaker economy, that was deemed responsible for the change. And some would argue that when the deficits got really big in the 60s and 70s, the mistake of the early Bretton Woods decisions pushed by Harry Dexter White began to rear its head in a way that began to undo Bretton Woods. And with the banking deregulation and the floating or market-set currencies replacing the fixed currencies, Bretton Woods went into really precipitous decline starting in the mid-1970s.
Well, I want to come back to that in just a second, but I just want to note that if we're talking now about a new Bretton Woods, we're talking about a situation in which the U.S. is now the nation with the great deficit, and I guess China would be one of the preeminent nations with the surplus. So the question of who wins the battle here will determine a lot about what our new financial architecture looks like.
Absolutely. China actually has fairly balanced trade on a net-net basis with all countries, so it doesn't have an enormous surplus with the world. It has an enormous surplus with the United States. And we have, unfortunately, an enormous deficit with the world, of which China is the biggest, but certainly not the only part. Although Chinese don't have the largest trade surplus in the world, but they certainly are a large surplus saver, and they do have an enormous surplus with the United States. China does not have a position of authority akin to the one the United States has, though.
Okay, well, let's go back now to what you started to say about what happened in the late 60s, early 70s. And that was the time in the wake of the inability to keep up with the debts being incurred by the Vietnam War that Nixon took the U.S. off the gold standard, correct?
Well, the United States stayed on the gold standard until I think it was August 22nd, 1971. The problem for the United States with the gold standard became that until Nixon removed us from the gold standard, you could take your dollars and turn them in, and the U.S. government would have to give you the gold equivalent, the number of, you know, the fraction of an ounce of gold that you got for $1. The problem with that is the United States had begun to run significant trade deficits with many of its trading partners, particularly Taiwan and France were very aggressively turning in their dollars and taking gold because they were afraid the dollar would fall. And as is the case in markets where all prophecies are self-fulfilling, they began to drain off the gold in the U.S. And Richard Nixon simply went on TV and announced that from thenceforward, there wouldn't be a gold standard. There'd be a paper dollar standard. And if you wanted to trade in your paper dollar for something, that's fine. The U.S. government would be happy to give you a new, shiny, crisp dollar. But that would be the only thing you could trade your dollar in for.
And so that's a huge change in what money is.
Right. So money ceases to be backed by gold, or what economists have historically called commodity money. So paper money being backed by a valuable commodity, in this case gold, and became what people call fiat money, or money that has value because the government says it has value by law, as opposed to because it's backed by any product with intrinsic value.
So when you have a fiat money supply, you can essentially have any amount of money at all running around, and the decision about how much there is a hugely important decision.
It's a policy decision, yeah, because the amount of money is no longer linked or restricted to the supply of gold, in the old case, backing the money, but is only linked and restricted by the policies made by people restricting or linking the amount of money to something like the rate of growth or price level, some quote-unquote arbitrary standard, and you've lost the backing of a valuable object like gold.
But in reality, even when we had a gold standard, there wasn't a one-to-one relationship. In other words, the amount of gold reserves to circulating dollars did change, and that could be changed. And it's just like modern banking where they said, well, look, nobody's going to come in and cash in all their dollars for gold, so we can keep a proportion in reserve. Is that correct?
Yeah, that's absolutely correct. And obviously, that's where the term debasing the currency comes from.
I see.
It comes from the old days when, you know, a ruler or an emperor, particularly looking to fund some lavish new capital or palace or expensive war, would literally debase the currency. So instead of being pure silver or gold or copper, the coins would have some cheaper metal put in there, and the sort of value, the copper, the gold, the silver in the coins would be reduced. The modern version of that, when we had the gold standard, was to allow more dollars per ounce of gold to circulate until, of course, we reached the fiat currency decision under President Nixon, and we no longer based our currency on gold.
And so what were some of the major decisions or changes in the financial architecture since that time, between the early 70s and today?
Well, there have been many, but probably if we were trying to get a short, simple list, we have a situation where there's been many global rounds in various countries of deregulation of the banking systems, allowing banks to pay more for deposits, charge more for loans, and make loans in larger quantities to larger groups under a larger range of conditions than were allowed before. Before this period and after the Bretton Woods, most currencies in the world were fixed until the late 70s. In other words, the governments set, through their central banks, conversion rates, a la you could get 7 French francs for 1 U.S. dollar or 4 Deutschmarks, or you could trade 2 U.S. dollars for 1 British pound sterling. And these were set and reviewed as policy by central banks and central bank authorities, government authorities in various countries.
And if I were out on the street with a pocket full of Deutschmarks and willing to trade them for dollars and traded them at an exchange ratio different than the approved ratio, I was basically operating on the black market and doing something illegal.
Yeah, and you could actually, in some countries, be shot, and in many countries, be fined or arrested. There were also capital controls, which strictly limited how much money you could take out of or bring in to economies around the world. You had to go through formal channels, often pay tax, and there was restriction on how much local currency you could convert or bring out of or into a national economy. And capital controls were the norm through the late 70s, and they were relaxed later. So you had fixed exchange rates, capital controls, and extreme regulatory restrictions on international financial movement.
And so what somebody might legitimately argue is that it was inappropriate and distorting to economies to have a government decide what an exchange rate was when it should be a market which, you know, valued what, you know, I don't know, toilet paper relative to widgets was worth if they were being made in different places. And so everybody would be better off if it was markets that were allowed to determine exchange rates. The problem being that you also have a whole lot of speculative activity that can occur that can cause huge distortions in the absence of any regulation. Is that a reasonable way to put it?
Well, there are two sort of big arguments. One is many governments were lousy at setting the currency rates, and there was all kinds of corruption and vested interest. So there were significant misadventures in which countries' currency rates were clearly out of whack and created all kinds of trouble. So, I mean, people did cite those, and they made good points in some cases and not so good points in others. In addition to which, the fixed exchange rates made international trade a little bit less flexible. Ideally, your currency would become cheaper if you were a huge net importer of goods and services, and then you would have a huge outflow of wealth from your country, and then your currency would become cheaper, and that would help to make imports more expensive and make your exports more competitive. And this would allow you to maybe regain your footing through flexible pricing if you were in a bad position in the global economy. And the fixed exchange rates tended to not do that, so they tended to make governments and national economies a bit less flexible, and this became more and more important as international trade steadily rose as the world rebuilt and we began to see more transnational corporate activity and more international trade in the decades following World War II.
And so, but what were the trends when you had this deregulations? What did it lead to, and at what point could you really see that the speculative component of what was going on ramping up significantly? When did that – is it possible to say, this happened at a given time?
We started having currency crises and international speculation increase as soon as we had deregulation.
So what was the first example?
I don't know what the very first example was.
Early example that stands out then.
Well, the early examples would probably be in 83 and 84, where you had rounds of massive currency crisis striking all over South America, in Mexico, and then all throughout.
And those currency crises were the result of huge foreign investment with the idea that those economies could expand, could accommodate those influx of investment by increasing the amount of true value that was being created, and then at some point people pulling the money out and the currency collapsing. Could you explain the mechanics of that a little bit?
There's a bit of an element of that. I mean, what you tended to see was large-level investment in a developing country with large inflows of capital, which then gets disappointed and people realize that they've overestimated the value of some of their investments, particularly in local currency terms, and that they've maybe begun to bank on, literally, a future for these countries and their growth, which may not come true, and they panic and they sell assets and try to get money out of the country, and this sort of fear becomes a bit of a stampede, money comes flowing out, the economy begins to fall apart in these countries, unemployment rises, sometimes social unrest rises, government tax revenues fall, demands on government spending rise, and the large number of folks trying to exit local investments means there's a huge pressure on the currency, then, if it's a fixed exchange rate, has to be revalued down. And if it's a floating exchange rate, it just gets sold off in the market.
So would it be correct to say
that... There's one more little thing I should mention, though, which is traditionally developing countries, when they borrow money, which they borrow a lot, in a boom, they usually borrow money in a foreign currency. In the case of Central and South America, they usually borrow in dollars. So if their currency falls as their economy shrinks, then the total amount of local currency they need to pay back on their dollar borrowings rises. So you have the unfortunate simultaneous shrinking of the economy, shrinking of government revenues, and what acts like an increase in debt because they've borrowed in dollars, they have to pay back in dollars, but the local currency is falling in value, or more units of local currency are required to equal $1. So it's as though their debt is rising just as their ability to repay that debt is shrinking, and just as their ability to attract loans from around the world is shrinking because people increasingly see them as risky and in bad shape.
Now, when this happens, one of the outcomes of it is that all those assets in that country have become devalued relative to the foreign currency. And so after such a collapse, isn't it the case that if you had foreign capital, you could come in and snap up assets, assuming that they were for sale, at fire sale prices, and gain quite a bit of wealth that way?
Sure, because two things have happened, right? The currency in which all the local prices are measured has collapsed, meaning everything is on sale. But because there's probably been a runaway from local assets and a crash in local prices, the price of everything has also fallen. So the price of the assets falls, and then the price of the currency in which those assets are priced falls, and you kind of have a double fire sale. And then for foreigners particularly, or local wealthy people whose money is not held in the local currency, they have stuff on sale and in a currency that's on sale. And, you know, great fortunes and great deals can be made by those who didn't hold their wealth in the local currency, whether those people are domestic institutions, wealthy people, or foreign institutions or foreign wealthy people. They can often come in and snap up assets on the cheap. And the other possibility is that countries desperate for help with failing and flailing economies can also be made to privatize or sell assets by other governments and other institutions, because you can make their willingness to sell things they might not have sold to foreigners before. You can basically insist that if they want assistance, they deregulate and allow that. So can you get a good price, you can sometimes get a good price on something that was never before and normally would not be on sale.
And wasn't that part of the agreements that the IMF would force countries, if they were going to get assistance, to go ahead and privatize previously nationalized assets. Is that correct?
Yeah, well, the IMF, working in some extent similar and its suggestion patterns to the Treasury, U.S. Treasury, and other institutions, has a standard series of suggestions for a country involved in a budget and currency crisis. And those tend to be to reduce government spending, increase interest rates domestically, and to be open to significant deregulation and privatization. And those particular pattern of suggestions can make it much easier for foreign investors or wealthy domestic investors who've held their money outside of the country to come in and buy assets fairly inexpensively. And this is part of the reason that around the world many people do not have the highest opinion of the IMF. It is perhaps worthy of note that the soon-to-be Treasury Secretary, now New York Fed personality, Tim Geithner, used to work at the IMF before going to the New York Fed.
And the process we were just talking about, is that the kind of thing that happened during what was called the Russian ruble crisis?
Yeah, the Asian financial crisis and Russian ruble crises, which began in 1997 and 1998, in many cases with a real estate collapse in Thailand, which affected the Thai baht, B-A-H-T, which is their currency, and then quickly spread around the world, was a period in which, at that point, many Western investors, as well as local very wealthy people in these countries, suddenly became scared about how much money they had bet in investing into these newly open, newly industrializing countries. And they got scared about how much they were paying for assets and how much money they had invested in these countries. And suddenly an inward flood of capital flows became an outward flood. People started running. And as soon as they started running, the asset prices began to collapse and the currencies began to collapse with them. And that was sort of one of the initial pushes toward what became known as the Asian financial crisis, but certainly did damage in South America, did damage in Turkey, did damage in Russia, you know, obviously places that are not in East Asia.
So now as we get into a period when we're going to build a, quote, new financial architecture, the rest of the world has to have acute and recent memories of these events, and they see at the helm now people who were, you know, critical, central in pushing the policies that led to their discomfort and dismay. What do you think is the relative distribution of power now between the crowd that between the United States, let's say, and some of these other countries? What's the, you know, who is in a position as these global financial architectures are going to be renegotiated to really exert a lot of sway?
I mean, part of the problem right now is it's really not clear. The free market ideology, where all privatizations and deregulations lead to only greater and greater wealth, is clearly in massive decline as a philosophy. That's true globally. It's true inside the United States. And it is very much unclear which countries or groups of countries will become the new leadership. And it could even include many of the old countries, which will simply be singing a new song from the same old podium. It's not exactly clear. It is clear that the central overarching power of the United States has been challenged by our failure to demonstrate military supremacy in Iraq and Afghanistan, and the extent to which the global financial crisis in many ways began here, and the trouble our economy is having. It will be difficult for the United States to go around the world in the next couple of years and tell everyone, you got to do it the way we do it, or you can't be rich and successful like we are. That message has certainly been a bit compromised by many things that have occurred here lately, but not least the financial and stock market really damage, a cataclysm here of late. So the bold first superpower status of the United States looks likely to be significantly compromised. As of yet, however, there is no clear replacement for the United States, and it looks more like multipolarity in the future, with the United States still the single biggest, but in a much reduced role. And you can begin to see what may possibly be the outlines of that new architecture in the, although unsuccessful largely, G20 meetings of last week, in which you see a much more prominent role for India, for China, for the European Union, and a bit of a receding of the United States from this position of massive, dominant, single, you know, unipolar power.
It seems to me that that situation is a little bit of a prescription for a very long, extended, and difficult to balance period of negotiation that could stretch years, where there's different kinds of jockeying and there are such different interests at play that they can't really come to a coherent solution. I mean, when you talk about the original Bretton Woods Agreement, it came in the wake of a protracted period of economic displacement around the world, followed by a major war, which led to the outcome where you had one really clear victor. And the dominance of that victor was able to drive the negotiation, I'd guess.
Well, you had two sort of clear victors, one of whom was outside of the Western capitalist economic system, so sort of dropped from prominence. So the United States and the former Soviet Union were probably the two big victors. You sort of had two. Mm-hmm. And to some extent, until 1990, you kind of had a bipolar world with two great powers. And it's really only been the last 15 to 18 years that the United States was kind of the sole superpower. So it's actually more the anomaly than the norm. However, economically, the United States has been the pretty easy to recognize dominant superpower for, you know, better than 53 years. So obviously that's true. I think you might be right that we may be in for a long period in which people aren't sure if they have to listen to other people and who they have to listen to, and there's lots of shifting alliances and uncertainty. And sadly, hopefully the G20 meeting, other than being open to many in terms of the invites, won't be that much of a model for the future, because it basically was several days of people sniffing each other out and then making a series of public relations announcements which don't really change anything, and they kind of kicked the can down the road to the next meeting when we do have a functioning U.S. president instead of a lame duck who's of marginal ability to influence a lame duck Congress for March or April, when we're going to see bigger decision-making, I think. But well, the initial meeting wasn't enormously a good omen, although it's good that one did occur.
To wrap this up, maybe you could comment, if you would, on what a protracted period of wild swings in the value of money and uncertainty about the nature of money is going to do to people who, like myself, like you possibly, and like a lot of our listeners, simply are trying to function and survive in an economy where we have savings, we have a set of financial obligations, and the rest of it. I mean, as people who are trying to make plans on what the hell to do in our role as economic actors, how do we approach a period like this?
Well, it's a difficult question to answer, but very much a good one. Part of what we've seen, vis-a-vis wild swings, is that the dollar has really become much more valuable in the last few months as people run to the United States, particularly Americans, but not just Americans, folks from all over the world run to the shelter, however strange that may sound to the ears of many of your listeners, of the United States.
And that could easily, just as easily go in reverse when some...
No, it will go in reverse. So it speaks to your point. I mean, at some point, people are going to realize that the dollar and the U.S. economy have a lot of problems, and some of that money is going to come running out of the United States just as fast as it came running in. And so the dollar, which has gone from 161 cents to buy a euro a few months ago to 123 cents to buy a euro today, which is a big move, is going to probably move sharply down, and that's going to be painful. And if it comes during a recession in the United States, then Americans will face poor job prospects, low wage growth, crime, and social problems that tend to accompany bad economic performance, just as their dollars, their currency, buys less goods and services from around the world. And that may be particularly painful because we import an awful lot of our basic goods, all of our toys, much of our furniture, all of our clothing, a significant portion of our food, and 75% of our hydrocarbon energy supply.
Well, it strikes me that there's one of two paths you need to go to get stability then. Either within a given currency regime, by which I mean within a given country, where you have a single currency, it seems like you either need to produce most of the key things you need to live and have imports be sort of an increment on top of that, marginal, not fundamental to your functioning, or you have to have a single global currency. And without one or the other, you are at the mercy of what's going on with all these exchange rates.
Yeah, you are. I mean, as many people around the world have discovered, we have seen, 30 or 40 major currency crises in the last 25 years. What we haven't seen is a sustained massive one in the United States. But people in many countries could certainly speak to this from firsthand experience. This problem may wash up in the U.S. shores, and that has a bigger global impact than many other crises, only because the United States' share of the global economy is much larger. So I don't know if we need to go as far as being autarkic, which I don't think would be optimal or necessarily even possible, but we do have to keep in mind that to the extent that we are exposed to significant currency risks and a quite good chance that the U.S. dollar doesn't do so well over the next few years, whatever we choose to import is going to become volatile and possibly more expensive as value pressure is put on the U.S. dollar. And that is something that I think is more a question of when than if. I mean, I hope I'm wrong, but I kind of doubt I will be.
Well, I want to thank you for spending this time. I want to tell our listeners you've been listening to Money and Values. You can find us online at moneyandvalues.net. There's a blog there if you want to share your thoughts with other listeners or with us. That's moneyandvalues.net. The program is licensed with a Creative Commons Attribution Non-Commercial Share-Alike 3.0 license. You can find out more about Creative Commons licenses online at creativecommons.org. Our theme music is Money Money by Marcus Thrower from the open source audio collection at archive.org. It's been great to have you, and we look forward to having you drop by and listen to another edition of Money and Values. Thanks a lot, Max, and have a great afternoon.
Thank you.
Take care. Bye-bye.
Bye.
Getting the dough for bank tellers, selling my soul, no. Reaching my goal, yes. Praying to God daily for making me so blessed. I'm riding with no vest, no business and no Lex. Give me money, money.
I need it. I
want
it. Money and everything. But it's most of it. I just feel it. I'm taking back what
get it, get it, get it. Money, money.
I
need
it. So I'm about to skip so I can stack a lot of money. Money and everything, but it's most of it. And you can always smell it when you come
through. Now you can overcharge your cards and you know you need a job. What you really, really need.
Money, money.